Miami Beach voters said yes to change. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The voters reelected Dan Gelber, and they voted for the 2 a.m. last call. So what now? And how much of the entertainment district in Miami Beach will change? Also, a new art exhibit looks at money, specifically the money from the Confederacy. It turns out that within those bills, there were images of slavery, and those images inspired the work of artist John W. Jones. Finally, Liz Oshevsky grew up around addiction, and it took a toll on her childhood. Today, she runs an organization called Horses Healing Hearts. It uses horses to help kids overcome the PTSD of family addictions. All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us. Miami Beach voters decided that Dan Gelber should get one more term to finish his work. And a big part of that work is to reshape the entertainment district because voters said yes to the 2 a.m. last call. What does the mayor and other city leaders want to do now? Well, joining us is Miami Beach Mayor Dan Gelber. Mayor Gelber, welcome to the program and congratulations on your victory.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
You won the race very easily. And again, as we said, the voters voted for the 2 a.m. last call. We'll get to that in a moment. But in this final term, you know, do you feel you're going to have enough time to make the changes you want to make?
Well, I think any time you have one of these jobs, and my father taught me this, and he was the mayor of our city also, you know, you have to expect that the most important things you're going to do might, you know, manifest themselves after you're out of office, and somebody else can get the credit if you do it right. And I think you have to have a long view of, especially of these kinds of changes. But I think we're going to definitely have time to do quite a bit. And certainly the residents told us that they want us to do quite a bit. So we're very anxious to get started.
Last time that we spoke to you was before spring break, and we were talking about your 12-point plan for the entertainment district to make it safer. I want to talk about one aspect of that plan, enhanced policing. Remind us of what you have in mind. How do you define that?
Well, I mean, I think we have to think about our city as a, you know, organically, 85,000 residents, but potentially 200,000 or 300,000 visitors on any single night, and many coming to, as we've seen, unfortunately, get a little too rowdy. Hopefully we'll stop that. So for policing, you've got to figure out how you address that. Number one, we need more police, and we are. When I became mayor, I think we had 390 police. We're going to be closer to 440 in this cycle. So we've increased our police substantially. We also have to increase we have to change the way we police, you know, so that these areas have more of a presence. It's difficult when you arrest people because when there's crowds and there's an arrest, it takes an enormous amount of a surge of police to sort of make an arrest and protect the scene. And that's always been very troubling for us. I don't believe we can police our way out of our challenges because I think it's dangerous for our cops and arrestees and residents and visitors. But we definitely need a more enhanced police presence. And we have to make sure that we don't, because of the challenges of these high impact weekends and high impact times, that we don't drain our police from other areas because, you know, we're basically a residential community. And most people, you know, don't live in the entertainment area. They live somewhere else, and they certainly expect that there is policing happening there.
And so coming back to this idea, as you said, when you have these big weekend events or you have a spring break, you have a lot of people, it's a challenge for police maybe sometimes to get order in an area. Is it then the goal to just reduce these big high weekend events? Is that what you'd like to see?
Well, I think it's deeper than that. I think, you know, we about 20 years ago, maybe longer, we created a entertainment only area, a party zone, basically in the city. And there's about 140 all night liquor licenses. It's not obviously all of them are being used, but a good number are. And we made it really for parties only. And I think that was a mistake, at least it is now, because now there's nothing else but that sort of activity, and that can be hard to sustain in police. So what we want to do is we want to make this area a live, work, play area. We want to encourage investment into galleries and boutique offices and residential, still have residents, still have restaurants, still have hotels and have bars, but not make the all-night bars the defining and only feature of the area. And I think that's why the 2 a.m. was so important. It doesn't solve all the problems, but it allows you to solve the problems because now you can reimagine and actually encourage investment into these things and these kinds of ventures that will make the area a little bit more accommodating to both visitors and residents, a true, as the term is used, live, work, play district.
So, of course, one of the things that the voters voted for as well, not just you, but also the 2 a.m. last call. We've been hearing from a lot of our listeners through the text club, just to read some of their comments. Gary from Wilton Manor says, quote, "I left Miami-Dade County and moved to Broward. I have no need to go to Miami Beach with its crime, hedonism, and chaos." Brandon from Hialeah says, "It's not often mentioned, but for some, availability to get a drink can feel like life or death. Also, 2 a.m. closings result in everyone exiting at the same time, whereas 5 a.m. closings give people time to slowly trickle out." And Zeke from Miami says, "I worked as a bartender in South Beach for many years. Closing bars at 2 will defeat the entertainment district's crowd control, which was its main idea when it was developed." I want to give you a chance to respond to these because you know the controversy was, people were saying to you, you're not going to deal with the crime. You're going to make things worse if you stop. The last call is at 2. But your response to what you're hearing from people.
Yeah, well, first of all, you know, a lot of the concerns act as if there's no place that has a 2 a.m. closing, when, of course, the reverse is true. Almost all places are 2 a.m. Almost all destinations are 2 a.m. or earlier. And almost all of the bars and restaurants in my city are 2 a.m. or earlier. So this idea that this is some kind of novel approach to, running a business or running a restaurant or bar is absurd, because most places are 2 a.m. or earlier. And most of the places in the city we're talking about, in the area we're talking about, are that early. So I think the idea that you can't, sustain a restaurant unless you're open all night long is absurd, because so many do. And this, of course, is a beautiful area which attracts so many people. So I'm not concerned really about that. I think businesses will thrive. They may have to change their business model. We may not see the all night cheap big drinks fueling the kind of disorder we've seen. It may be a slightly elevated or more cultural experience, but it'll be embracing to all guests, and it will be different than what we have now, which is something where a lot of people don't feel comfortable. The idea that everybody's going to rush out of the bars at 2 a.m. and go somewhere else, that doesn't happen in places. It's just sort of, this thing was, I think, made up by the bars that didn't like the rollback because they like making money all night long and not really caring about the disorder that's happened.
Do you think that the ending at having the 2 a.m. last call, is that going to play a role in crime statistics?
Oh, yeah. Well, for a variety of reasons. Number one, when you have a party-only district, then nothing else is really going on there but a party, not just late at night and in the morning, but, of course, all day long. So when you create a live-work-play area, it's a more orderly area because there's activations like galleries and shops and, offices during the day. It's not a party-only district, so it's always going to be less problematic. And, of course, the other thing is, when you're an all-night district and you have that kind of activity all night long, your police are really taxed and they're really hard to police, those shifts. And so for us, when we put our cops on Alpha Bravo, which is 12-hour shifts, when we have these high moments, we bring in cops from other districts, school board cops. It's really quite an effort to just keep some level of order. And by the way, we haven't been particularly successful, because if you look at the scenes and images coming from my city during some of these times, they're really, they're terrible.
And so those images can go viral, and then that doesn't always have the context. I mean, I was looking at the crime statistics, trying to figure it out. The hard part is that when you look at those statistics, they don't always tell you exactly where, I'm just getting the basic statistics from the state, and they don't always tell you when it happened or where exactly it happened. And but some of it, you could tell, it didn't all happen in the entertainment district. Some of your serious crimes are taking place other times of the day in other parts of the city. So, I mean, you know, the argument to get on the crime, you know, in that 3 hour span, do you know something I haven't found that shows?
I know the metrics quite well. First of all, we have heat maps of the types of crimes that occur. And in this little entertainment district, which is from 5 to 16, two blocks wide, you know, nine to 10 blocks long, a postage stamp, literally, in our city, about 20% of the major crime happens. Think about that. And in the area around it, an even greater percentage. So the heat maps that show where the major property and crimes of violence happen are all there. And by the way, 90% of that crime is by visitors upon visitors. And I would argue that the 10% that are not are probably our homeless population who get arrested. Almost no residents are victims and almost no residents are perpetrators. And the point I'm making is that we are policing a playground of other people. That's what our cops do all day long. You know, someone said you got to get the word out and let everybody know or get the recidivists. We rarely have the recidivists other than our homeless population, because almost everybody who gives us trouble is just got off a plane, you know, an hour earlier than that. So it's a very unique policing problem, because unlike most other cities where it's your residents can often be your victims or your perpetrators, it's almost never that in our city. And when you look at the major crime, not, you know, the sort of minor crimes, so you look at the major crimes, it's almost always a visitor committing a crime upon a visitor. So that tells you they're here for this area.
All right. Again, talking with Miami Beach Mayor Dan Gelber. Again, he won his third term this past week. And voters of Miami Beach also voted for the 2 a.m. last call. We've been hearing from you through our text club, like Jesse Walcott, a bar owner in Margate. He says, what about the people who work until 11 or 12 at night and would like to go out after closing at 2 a.m.? What are they going to do? Don't people who work the night shift and the late shift deserve a chance to relax? Liz from Key Largo says, I think giving patrons even more access to alcohol is a bad idea. Self-policing, unfortunately, does not work, and those living in nearby neighborhoods have to deal with the issues that evolve from non-locals. Mayor, I have to ask you about this, the story that came out in the Miami New Times, and it was about the Zoom call that you were on with the city manager, former mayor Philip Levine, and some developers. Was that a public meeting?
No, and it wasn't. I don't know how many people were in the call. I think there were 40 or 50, but I'll tell you what it was, because it's been very misrepresented. The fellow that recorded it spliced it in a very out of context way. But I'll tell you exactly what it is, because I urge people to listen to the whole video. It's about the whole audio, the whole 30 minutes, because what I said there, I say all the time in meetings that are public, commission meetings. I have most of that information posted on the website. Here's what that meeting was. Most of this area is not owned by the city. In fact, none of it is. It's owned by the private sector. And right now there's an absurd amount of Airbnbs and all-night bars. I have been for 2 years asking developers, hoteliers, proprietors, business people to invest in that area and convert it into something that fits more the live, work, play cultural profile of our city. So I meet all the time with people. What was amazing is that this fellow just sort of, he was a candidate who had had been disgraced. He had lied about where he voted previously, so he was thrown off the ballot. So he put together this silly audio, and I say everything on there that I say publicly all the time. In fact, I have of my 12-point plan that I think we spoke about, point three is literally what I was talking about. I urge people all the time to invest, and I tell them that if they need some kind of us to do something. For instance, I have an ordinance that will allow an extra floor or two on Collins Avenue that's set back to allow people to maybe upscale the hotel so it's no longer an Airbnb or make it an office.
Well, let me ask you about this, because one of the things in the meeting in the audio is that somebody had mentioned creating a PAC to support the candidates.
Yeah, by the way, that absolutely, listen to the whole thing. And it's terrible that people don't. One of the people there said, well, maybe we should get a PAC to get the other commissioners to go along with it. And immediately I said, well, it's not appropriate for us to talk about that with the manager there. By the way, I could talk about a PAC if I wanted to. as you probably know, but I didn't feel like our manager should be listening, because we meet with people all the time in my office, in their offices, out on the scene, where we ask them to look at an area and say, what could we do with this that's different than the use that's it's going on now? So somebody brought up a PAC. There is no PAC, by the way. I never asked anybody to donate because there's no PAC. But more than that, I said, because our manager was there, that she really shouldn't be in a room where somebody starts talking about that. And I said it immediately, and that's well documented.
And by the way, I didn't say that you had said that. Somebody else on the tape had said that. I wanted to ask you about this before we finish up. As I've been mentioning, voters said yes to the 2 a.m. last call. We did hear from David Wallach. He's the owner of the restaurant and nightclub Mango's Tropical Cafe.
Miami Beach is in the midst of a fragile economic recovery. Hospitality workers and business owners are still recovering from losses brought on by the pandemic. And to limit our hours adds another obstacle to businesses and workers in our road to recovery. And that gives us all a lot of worry. As business owners, we don't want to let staff go or close our doors. And our workers are concerned they won't be able to make ends meet with fewer hours and fewer tourists.
So, Mayor, I want to start with this. What is your plan now in implementing the 2 a.m. last call? How soon do you think you're going to put that in? And the other thing you said earlier was that maybe businesses are going to have to rethink how they do business. But what is the city going to do to help them?
Well, first of all, I like Mr. Wallach. We get along well, and I hold no personal animus to him. But, you know, we've heard from him, well, this is only three bars. Why are we making such a big deal about it? Then we hear it's going to cost $200 million. They really sent the last months, they would say virtually anything to scare the public to not do this. Bars are often open till 2 and not 5. They're going to just have to do that. It's just, I mean, that's the way it's going to be.
Are you going to start this soon, though? When do you expect?
Well, the commission is going to have to decide how to sort of implement it. But I imagine that certainly in this entertainment area where the problem is the most, we will have a pretty. It should be in a few months from now. We should have a ordinance put into place that will limit, sales of alcohol and consumption too. I believe at 2 a.m. They've talked about whether we have other exemptions for hotels of a certain size that don't really impact the street and the neighborhood in any way, or have their own security and security plans. But that's something the commission will have to decide. And there's 7 of us, so any 4 will make that decision. But this is going to happen. And by the way, it's not going to affect that many. It's really not, but it is going to set a clear tone and a message to the world that this hard party is not what we want in the city. If you look at our city, it has such a high cultural profile, just the architecture, the museums, the venues, the restaurants, the hotels. Many of them are so nice. We have to get that.
Okay, you have that. That's true. But you still are a place where a lot of young people set their spring break to come to Miami Beach. This is where they want to be.
I'll put it to you simply. We do not want to be somebody else's rite of passage. Okay, because you know what? If you think about living in a neighborhood like in Flamingo Park and having a bunch of people, drunk walking in your front yard. It's just, I mean, we don't want people to do here what they wouldn't do in their own hometown. And we have so many other things to attract people here, from the beaches to the architecture to the culture to the restaurants and venues. We don't need to offer a do anything, anything goes, kind of place.
Yeah.
We don't need that. I think we sell ourselves short. We're a cultural destination, and that's what we want. Well, so we have a right to tell people what we expect of them when they're going our guests coming here. And we also, I think, have a right to present to them sort of the things that we think you know, they'll like. But have to be a party only place. That's not what we want to be.
I'm going to stop it there only because of time. But this is a conversation. All right. As the commission moves forward, we'll have you back, and we're going to talk about how you're going to reshape the entertainment district. But Mayor, thank you as always. I really appreciate
the time.
Thank
you very much. Thanks.
Again, that is Miami Beach Mayor Dan Gelber. He won his third term this past week. Hearing from all of you, Leslie in Palmetto Bay says, cutting off alcohol sales at 2 a.m. is a must-do idea. The well-being of the community means more than money. For too long, money has spoken louder than safety and mental health. Tanya in Kendall says, a change in the closing time will affect Miami Beach residents by bringing less revenue. The city has long since had a reputation of debauchery. If you don't like it, don't live there. We're going to find out what happens to the city over time, and we'll keep up on this story. Well, coming up in 15 minutes, there's a program that uses horses to heal children who grew up with addiction. But first, we're going to talk about an art exhibit in Broward that will make you think differently about slavery. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. You know, if you look at money that was printed by the Confederate South during the Civil War, you'll notice something really interesting on the bills. A lot of images of enslaved people. African-American artist John W. Jones recreated a lot of those images into these beautiful, colorful paintings. His goal is to provide a sense of dignity for the enslaved people and to shed new light on the relationship between slavery and America's economic power. Well, those paintings are on display at the African American Research Library and Cultural Center in Broward. Joining us now is Makiba Foster, who is the library regional manager. Makiba, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Louis. Happy to be here.
Great to have you. Also joining us is Dwayne Rayner. He is the executive director of the organization Partners in Racial Justice, who is also co-produced this exhibit. Dwayne, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me. Thank you so much.
You know, Dwayne, I want to start with you. A little bit of an art aficionado, not going to say that I know everything, but I didn't know a lot about John W. Jones. This is fascinating work. Please tell me a little bit about his story.
Well, Jones is an artist, and his story is fascinating. It's he was working in a print shop, and he realized these currencies that came in, and he decided to say, well, let me look at it closer. And he found these, you know, pictures of enslaved individuals on the cover, and he decided to make art out of it. I just got to recently know him. He was actually referred to me by a fellow friend and board member of Partners in Racial Justice. But his art exhibit has been on display for over 20 years. It's been mentioned in several national publications, from the New York Times to the Boston Globe. But he has basically unearthed a hidden treasure in terms of the history of this country as it relates to economics and slavery. So it's fascinating that he's been able to do that and just kind of happened upon it due to his work working in a print shop.
You know, and when you look at the images, it's something that could just pass over you if you're not even stopping to think about it. But yes, on the Confederate bills, you have all of these images of, I guess, you know, what drove their economy. And it was slavery at the time. Makiba, did you know about those images? And I wonder what you thought when you first saw them.
Well, Louis, I heard about the artwork probably early in its existence. I learned about it in graduate school, but when the opportunity came for it to possibly be exhibited in the African American Research Library and Cultural Center, I thought that it was a really wonderful opportunity, particularly because we're still faced with a lot of the issues that involved the Civil War. We're still fighting those same kind of cultural wars in terms of history and things like that. So I've known about it for a while, but being the leader of this organization has allowed me the opportunity to bring it to this community.
You learned it in grad school, right?
Right.
So a little bit later in life that you know that
right?
you learned
well,
about this. Yeah.
I won't tell you how many years that's been. But
but you know what, the other interesting thing too, because you grew up in Alabama.
I did.
And so, I mean, that was part of the Deep South of the Confederacy, where Florida played a very small role in comparison. But I wonder, like growing up, you know, how often is that brought up in conversation? How often is that history brought up?
I mean, you live with the legacy of civil rights, so the Rosa Parks, the all of those things that are important in terms of understanding from whence we came and trying to advance a more just and equitable society. But the nuance of actually like the propaganda of the bills is really sort of mind-blowing, particularly when you think about the contradictions of enslaved labor being the basis of the powerhouse of our economy. But even on that labor that fuels the economy on the paper of those bills is images of happy enslaved people never aspiring to arise above picking cotton or tobacco in fields. So yeah, though that kind of nuance, you get I Have a Dream, you get Rosa Parks, and I'm not taking anything away from that. But this kind of more detailed look at history was not always given.
And by the way, thank you for mentioning that because, yes, the way they depicted these enslaved people, it almost seemed like that they were happy with their lot in life, and that was just normal. Dwayne, you know, I think maybe a lot of us don't we don't think about it that often, but what do we get wrong about the relationship between slavery and the foundation of this country's economy?
Well, I'll just refer back to what you were saying earlier. I mean, I grew up in Florida, and any depiction of slavery that I ever saw in the history books in school was very limited, and it was had the happy enslaved individual. And we didn't really spend much time talking about it. So it's easy to overlook a history here that's not being taught because it's not something that's been out in the forefront. What I think we overlook in learning to these untold truths is the fact that America has built the most powerful economy in the world. And any business person knows that if you can reduce your labor costs, you have a tremendous competitive advantage over any competitor. So to have free labor, especially when it comes to the textiles and the cotton for so many years, allowed the growth of this economy to really boom and take off. There's been tremendous articles and numerous books written about that, but for some reason, it hasn't made it into the mainstream or into academia at the high school or junior high school level. So people don't really learn about this. So it does get overlooked to recognize that America's greatness in terms of economic power would not have been there had it not been for the enslaved individuals whose backs it was built upon.
Talking with Dwayne Rayner, the executive director of the organization Partners in Racial Justice. Also, Makiba Foster, she leads the African American Research Library and Cultural Center in Broward. We're talking about an exhibit displayed there at the center about Confederate money and how those bills featured images of enslaved people. And it was African American artist John W. Jones who recreated those images into these incredible, beautiful, vivid paintings. But doing it in a way, he wanted to provide, again, a sense of dignity for those enslaved people. You can find out more information. And by the way, see some of those images on our social media at WLRN Sundial. And again, that exhibit opened today, just to so you know. Dwayne, something really fascinating is in your last answer, I was just thinking, you know, this is the hot debate right now. It's like, what are we teaching kids? And the hot debate right now is this idea of critical race theory. But it's what we're not teaching kids in schools. People want to say that we're teaching the wrong thing, but we're not even teaching it, right? It's not. I remember the history books. It was a paragraph or two at best.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So, did you have a question there? I was going to comment on that.
Yeah, no, please go ahead. I want to hear your thoughts on that.
No, I mean, we're not teaching it. It's something that is a delicate and sensitive subject, you know, for whatever reason. You know, we tend to think as this country that it's better not to have history than to tend to teach it, you know, and the reality of the situation is that we have racism as a foundation of this country's, you know, economic system. And if we don't reckon with it by at least acknowledging the truth, we never will get to the sense of overcoming it because we keep trying to hide it. Of bringing these things up is to make people feel bad or situations where their children are feeling inferior. But if you have a history and you want to hold up the moral standards to the world that we claim to have, you have to acknowledge it and deal with it and reckon with it. And then we can kind of have these conversations that allow us to move forward. As long as people try to hide it, it's going to continue to fester, and it's going to continue to create, you know, all kinds of misinformation that people grow up with as adults, not really truly understanding what the cause and the root source of much of the problems in this country are as it relates to race.
Yeah.
I think it's an answer to start having these discussions. No, that's it. I just think it's an answer to have these discussions.
Right. Yeah. And you know, just look, a lot of countries have, those that have been around a long time have very unique histories, and sometimes there's a lot of darkness in that history. And the ones that accept it and talk about it openly are, you know, I think better off than those who try to hide it. Makiba, one of the interesting things about this too is this is being, you know, the cultural center is located in the historic Sistrunk neighborhood, so there's an extra added significance to this exhibit.
Absolutely. So one of the things that's important for us, and Dwayne mentioned the idea of misinformation as a library, as a space to provide accurate and clear information. This is one of the things that we feel is a duty and a mission of our work, is to be able to not only celebrate Black history, but all of the nuances of that. And so part of this exhibit does that. But back to the Sistrunk community, this is one of the oldest Black communities within Broward County. And our work also is to create space within this community where people can enjoy or experience art without having to leave out of their community. So this is also important in that aspect, particularly looking at how John Jones, as an artist, saw this and then was inspired to actually create some conversations and challenge some of those assumptions and the things probably that he also was taught about history and seeing these banknotes. And one of the things, I really encourage you all to come out and see it. One of the things that I thought was really interesting when I actually laid my eyes on it is that some of these, so they're banknotes, currency, but then there are also like financial banking institutions. And one of the notes that we have is not that old. It was, I can't remember what state it is, but it was a financial institution. And you have the, you know, at the bottom of the checks where you have the routing number and all of the image at the bottom.
Right.
Well, at the top of that check was still an image of an enslaved person. So I'm thinking this piece can't be older than 30, 40 years, but still those images are lingering with us. And so this is just a really wonderful opportunity. You will be challenged when you come into this space, but it's challenging in assumptions and what we think, and really trying to work towards a space where we create a more inclusive telling of history. And one of the ways that that we can do that is through art. Art allows us to speak to things sometimes that is hard to do when we're just having just regular conversation. So,
Dwayne, is there one of the Jones paintings that really stands out for you?
You know, there are several, but I guess I would pick, there's one where they're loading cotton onto a wagon, you know. And, you know, I grew up in Florida. My parents grew up in North Carolina, and they're both in their 90s, and they both pick cotton. You know, it's not something they were proud of, but they pick cotton. They would get paid by the pound. And before them, their parents were sharecroppers. So it stuck to me because of the history I have here in this country, especially in North Carolina. But then the way it's symbolized is like the way the artist has symbolized it. He's taken some license to show the cotton, and he's taken it and made it money in the wagon rather than cotton. Mm. And the enslaved individuals are loading this money onto the wagon, and the slave owners are there reaping all the rewards from the money. So it's a depiction, as Makiba talked about, of how inherently, intrinsically connected these economics and enslaved individuals are. And he does it in one piece that kind of shows that they're not getting paid for that. You know, they're getting, you know, my dad would tell me stories about how his grandfather would just get a bushel of potatoes and some corn at the end of the year for his work. You know, but the labor that was producing all this was cash into the hands of the owners. And it's just a very powerful depiction in that way.
The exhibit, again, is titled Confederate Currency, The Color of Money. It's open to the public starting today, and it runs through January of next year. I want to thank my guest, Dwayne Rayner, again, Executive Director of the organization Partners in Racial Justice. Also, Makiba Foster, the Library Regional Manager for the African American Research Library and Cultural Center in Broward. And you can get more information about the exhibit and the events happening around it. Just go to our website, WLRN.org, and it is something definitely to check out. Dwayne, Makiba, thank you so much for the insight.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And I just wanted to say you could also go to partnersinracialjustice.org because there's also going to be other activities and conversations surrounding this topic that the community will be involved in to help really focus on this topic of racial healing and discussions about the truths of untold history.
Thank you so much for sharing that with us. I really appreciate it, Dwayne. Well, still to come, we're going to meet the woman behind a group that helps kids who grow up around substance abuse, and she does it with horses. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Almost one in four kids in the U.S. grow up in a home where substance abuse is present. That's according to the National Institute on Drug Abuse. That was the story for Liz Osheski. She eventually launched a group where kids who grew up with substance abuse in the home can find healing by learning how to ride and care for horses. Now, there's a documentary called Without Wings that focuses on Liz's story and her group, and that film is showing this weekend at the Fort Lauderdale Film Festival. And I want to welcome Liz to the program now. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me, Louis. Thank you.
Tell me about your experience, first of all, with horses. Like, when did that start in your life?
I was 12 years old, and my Aunt Susie in Pennsylvania introduced me to a rescued Mustang. And that pretty much changed my life. That was the beginning.
And did you have a name for him?
Jonathan.
Jonathan.
Yeah, Jonathan. She actually, when she found him, they called him Jack and the Beanstalk because he was so wild that he actually put his hooves between the slats of the boards. He would try and crawl out of the stall. And she found it fitting to change it from Jack to Jonathan. That was a much more fitting name for him. So his name was Jonathan. He was a very special horse.
I want to ask you about your story, because that's what launched this, the Horses Healing Hearts program. But it was your mom and others close to you dealt with alcohol addiction. And so that was part of your childhood, growing up in that environment. Tell me a little bit about that experience for you and what it did to you as a child.
Yes, it was. So I really think my mom began drinking and was an alcoholic probably before I was born. But growing up, you know your family's very different, but you don't know how. And there's really no one to talk to about it. So it's a really confusing time. But when I was six, they divorced my parents and my two brothers and I, we moved to Ohio back from Tennessee, and she married another man who was an alcoholic. And, you know, it was just this pattern of people who have an addiction tend to hang out with people who also use. So sometimes you know, from day to day, you don't know what you're going to get. Sometimes you get a very logical, loving person, and then you don't know when the other shoe is going to fall. So that's the inconsistency is what's most traumatizing, I think.
Were you able to have any semblance of a normal childhood? What kind of kid were you?
But there are a lot of times when my loving mom came through, but I normalcy, no, I would say it was anything but normal. When my mom was given 6 months to live when I was 14, the doctors ended up being 10 years off and she lived another 10 years, but at the time I didn't know it. So when I was 14, my aunt, not the aunt with the horse, but another aunt in Dayton, brought me into her home and literally took guardianship of me. And that was the beginning of and I don't like the word normal because I think normal is a dial on a a washing machine that just dictates the size of a load. So I don't really think there's a normal. I think there's healthy and unhealthy and everything in between. But I had structure and I had the beginnings of a healthier, much healthier life. So that's kind of when my life began becoming predictable, if you will, and I started getting help. But I the remnants of what I had been through followed me through adulthood. But I look back on it and I never want to look back on it and say I regret it, because it's made me who I am. And children of alcoholics are generally are very resilient people. And if we get help and we get a prevention program or someone positive or a mentor in our life, we can change the world. I mean, we can take that resiliency and really put it in a positive frame and framework and do something with it. It's when we don't have positive intervening factors that it can go south really quickly.
Yeah. So I'm wondering, like, you know, at that early stage in your life when Jonathan the horse comes into your life, how did that help you in that resiliency that you're talking about?
Well, I immediately bonded with him. There's and I don't know how to put into words what horses do for us. It's really majestical and magical, and not to get too woo-woo, but horses just, they just bond. They help us kind of get in touch and get in our bodies and get out of our heads. But more than Jonathan in that summer, it was me being with my aunt who lived a healthy lifestyle, and I was able to talk to her openly about what I was going through. And in the movie, I say it takes a village. I mean, there was teachers that I could connect with and be honest with. And there were, you know, several people in my life, other relatives. So it wasn't just a horse. I say there was like an aunt, a horse, and a village. You know, if I had a book, that would be the name of the book. An aunt, a horse, and a village that saved me. But it's truly horses and mentors. So, that's it.
Yeah. Again, talking with Liz Osheski. She's the founder and executive director of Horses Healing Hearts. The nonprofit organization helps at-risk youth and doing it, building these relationships with horses the way she did. There's a documentary, as I mentioned, that looks at her organization and what and the work she's doing. It's titled Without Wings, and that is premiering at the Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival this Saturday. Find more information about the film screening and the show times. Go to our website, WLRN.org. So, Liz, when did the idea for Horses Healing Hearts come into your life? Because I remember watching the film. There was one point your husband said, it's probably not going to work. But you still did it anyway.
Yeah, he pretty much prompted me. I was doing this exercise that Tony Robbins recommends about. It's called the rocking chair test, where you literally like envision your funeral, which sounds kind of morbid. But I realized as I was envisioning my funeral that everybody who was very friendly there was commenting how I was kind of an extension of being helping him with the business. And I thought, I'm really put on this earth to do more than that. And I wanted to leave a legacy, and I wanted to help children who stood where I once or standing where I once stood. So I thought, how can I do that and use horses? Cause that's my passion. And I just kind of sat on the idea for a few months, and then I was volunteering somewhere and the idea popped in my head, and I pursued it. And again, I think people who love you don't want to see you get hurt. They don't want to see you fail. And that I think my husband was well-intentioned. But I'm one of those personalities, like, don't you dare challenge me.
It turns out that maybe him doing that, as you said, goaded you into doing it. Do you remember those first kids that you brought in, and maybe that was the first time they ever saw a horse up close? Because I want to know what it was like for them.
Yeah, they had actually seen horses. But those first kids were indeed probably some of the most traumatized kids I worked with. And we didn't have the resources. So we would, you know, go to different barns. And ironically, you know, one thing we did was we taught them a handshake, which sounds really silly, but no one had taught them how to shake hands. And when we taught them how to do that, the next week, the girl got to do it again. And at the end of the session, when we got back in my car, which I just shiver because I was driving them around in my car, and now we have insurance and I can't ever imagine doing that again. But I asked her what the best time of the day was, and I figured it was being on the horse. And she said, no, it was the handshake, because the lady I shook hands with knew I did it well, and I knew I did it well. And then I think, you know what? She's going to use that the rest of her life. Well, we're given COVID. I don't know if we'll ever go back to shaking hands. But the point was, you know, it was a skill that she's going to carry with her the rest of her life.
Yeah. I wanted to play a quick cut from the film, because we hear from some of these kids and the experiences they get just even being around the horses. Let's take a listen.
Riding a horse is like riding on a cloud. And like you're in heaven and you're with God. It's maybe overcome my fear of anything at all.
So Liz, I mean, you know, tell me what you see in the kids as they spend time with these horses, the kind of things that you're teaching them, but how they change over time.
I see such hope and empowerment. I mean, these kids come in and, you see their body language. A lot of they just look down at the ground and they're angry and they're frustrated and they feel like they have no control. That's one of the most difficult situations to live in, a home where you're watching someone you love destroy themselves. And their job is to protect you. And not only are they not protecting you, but they're destroying themselves. And it's so confusing. And so they come there and, it's such a complex disease. And then they get around this horse. And in our job, I say, is to almost stay out of the way and let the horse do the magic. And you just watch their eyes light up and that bond happen. And when they leave there, the smile that just is ear to ear. And then I hear during the week how excited they are to come back. And it's humbling. I think I was telling reporter before, I'm amazed that after 11 years, every single time I work with them, I learn something from the horse or the child. And I mean, it shouldn't amaze me, because they're just amazing kids and great animals. But it's what keeps me going, and I won't stop. I mean, it just can't stop. Our goal is to go nationwide, so we're excited for that.
You know, thinking about your story and, again, the work you're doing with the kids, I mean, addiction and the trauma for these kids, there's a stigma to it, and it's hard for them to deal with it, as you pointed out. What's the message that you have for young people, you know, in seeking out help, or if they're having trouble speaking up, where to start? What would you say to them? Again, because you know their story, you share it.
Mm-hmm. Well, the stigma is, unfortunately, it's getting better, but I don't know that we'll ever see it get where it needs to be in our lifetime. The message to the kids, I would say, is it's not your fault and you're not alone. And there is hope. I mean, the 1 in 4 is the 3 most important things that they would know. And the message to the people who work with them, because I remember families and adults looking at our family, and I could read their eyes, and I could tell they were saying, like, I want to help these people, but I don't want to irritate this mom. You know, my mom scared people. She was like beautiful, and her presence was very impressive, but she was a strong personality. And you don't have to call the police. You can just listen to that child. If you have a moment private where you can just be a loving ear and listen, these kids want to be heard. They just want to be heard. And we train our volunteers how to do reflective listening. People underestimate the power. If you're a coach, a teacher, a neighbor, someone in church, I'm not sure people always understand the value that they have in a young person's life, and just being present and taking 10 minutes on a regular basis to listen to a child is powerful.
I got to tell you, watching this film, you know, you could see it, the connection these children make with the horse and how it brightens them up and lightens them, gives them something else to think about and feel. Really powerful and really beautiful. Liz Osheski, again, a founder and executive director of Horses Healing Hearts. The documentary film about her story and this organization is called Without Wings, again premiering at the Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival on Saturday. Liz, thank you so much for sharing this story, and continued success for you.
Thank you, Louise, for having me. I appreciate it.
And you can find more information, by the way, about the film screening, the show times, and again, about this organization on our website, WLRN.org. And that's Sundial for this Thursday, November 4th. Leslie Ovalle is our producer and social media editor. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Amber Mortigy was helping out with production. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's interim program director and technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. The man pushing the buttons, Richard Ives. Our theme music is by the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Palo at gopalo.com. Right now, though, you're hearing a little Rolling Stones. Let's go out on that note. Well, coming up next week on the show, we're going to talk with a medical expert about vaccines for kids. And we want to hear from you. If you've got questions about the COVID vaccine and your child, text us now, 786-677-0767. Again, that's 786-677-0767, or email us sundial at WLRNnews.org. We're going to post your questions to the doctor and help you understand what this vaccine can mean for your child and your family. All of that coming up and more next week on the program. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe. Be good to each other. Have a great weekend. We're back live on Monday. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
WLRN Public Media.